From NPR and WBUR, I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm Scott Tong. This is Here and Now. Today on Ukraine's Independence Day, we think about what comes next, exactly 6 months into Russia's unprovoked invasion. We have on the line America's number two diplomat, Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman. Deputy Secretary, thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you all.
What is your assessment of the last 6 months of war and where things stand now?
You know, Scott, you mentioned something that's really important. It's so ironic that today is Ukraine Independence Day, on the same day that we're marking 6 months of Russia's unjust, unprovoked, and premeditated invasion of a sovereign country. And I think what we have seen is that the people of Ukraine, first and foremost, have extraordinary, extraordinary courage and resilience and commitment to stand up for their country, for democracy. You know, I think of our own Independence Day and how we all come together in many ways on July 4th to reaffirm how much it means to us to have the freedoms that we do, no matter what your political persuasion is. And I think the whole world admires the Ukrainian people today, as we should. I think we've also ensured that the alliance, our partners, have been knitted together, that the world has stood with Ukraine, helped them to provide the weapons, the security assistance, the financial assistance to defend their country, to hold up what their people are trying to do.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned
the... ensure we move forward.
Sorry to jump in. You mentioned
That's
the assistance.
Okay.
The administration has sent more than $10 billion in military aid. Today, it is announcing $3 billion more. But to a lot of Americans, this war looks like a stalemate when they look at the map, perhaps a World War I-style war of attrition. Is more military aid going to appreciably change the outcome?
I think we've seen that the systems that have been sent to Ukraine have changed the outcome, have given Ukraine capabilities that it didn't have to be able to not only defend territory, but to push the Russians back. The Russians have actually made sort of millimeter by millimeter progress. And in many cases, as I said, Ukraine has been able to push them back. This is a tough war. There's no doubt about it. Russia has one of the largest militaries in the world, and they have advanced weapon systems. But the world has come together. More than 50 countries have provided assistance to Ukraine. So this is not just an American endeavor, because I know American citizens would want to make sure that others are helping Ukraine as well, and indeed they are.
And Americans are also moving about seeing these gas station prices in their neighborhoods. Before the war began, a gallon went for about $3.30. It went up to $5. Natural gas for heating also costs more. What will the cost of this war be to the American people?
Well, I think we've also seen the price of gasoline come down. I don't know what today's level is, but I know it was around four, maybe even a little bit below.
A little under four is the national average, I believe.
Yeah, a little under four. So I think we're getting back to a more normal cost for gasoline. We all fill up our cars. We all see it. We all care about it. And the president has cared about it. It's why he has let out oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. It's why he's gone to others in the world to urge them to increase their capacity. It's why we've provided some support to countries to manage their energy needs. It's why, quite frankly, he has pushed, and in the recent inflation reduction bill, make sure that we increase our renewables and urge countries around the world to increase their renewables, because nobody wants to be in this position where we can't manage energy prices. It's a high priority for the for the Secretary of State, for the President of the United States, to try to help the American people. And we've seen that that help has begun to bring gas prices down considerably.
Deputy Secretary, you are a veteran negotiator. You have negotiated with counterparts from North Korea, from Iran. Part of your job is to get into the heads of others across the table. At this moment, what is in the heads of your counterparts in Moscow and in Kyiv?
Sadly, I believe that President Putin is committed to sustaining this illegal, unprovoked invasion into a sovereign country. Countries around the world have ascribed to the UN Charter, which is about sovereignty of countries, territorial integrity, that means the borders of the countries are sacrosanct, and the ability for countries to decide their own future. Not all countries are approaching lives in their countries in the same way we are. That's fine as long as we have a rules-based order and everybody's playing by those same rules. So I think, unfortunately, President Putin has decided that Ukraine, for some reason, belongs to him, and he's going to pursue this. It perhaps helps to take the minds off of the poor economy in Russia, which has gotten even worse during this time. The sanctions are biting that we have put in place, the export controls. Now they're trying to produce cars that don't have emissions control, don't have air conditioning, don't have any computer elements because they can't get that. They're seeing a drop in their GDP, and over time, this is going to get worse and worse for the Russian
people. And forgive me for one last very quick question, running out of time. But if we call you back in another 6 months, and this is your invitation, February 24th, 2023, will this war be over?
I certainly hope so.
Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
In Kyiv, the capital of Ukraine, the day began with air raid sirens, and Russian military forces have been shelling cities across the country. John Hudson is a national security reporter for our editorial partner, The Washington Post, and joins us from Kyiv. Hi, John.
Hey, Celeste.
So this is the first time that Ukraine has marked their Independence Day since the war began. What is the mood like?
It's an interesting mood. There is a lot fewer people in the streets than you see on a normal day in Kyiv. The residents of Kyiv have become pretty accustomed to the war, and you will see people relaxing, hanging out at restaurants, bars, on a normal day. Now, ahead of the Independence Day, you had two real strong warnings, one from Zelensky saying that the Russians could be planning a hideous attack, and one from the U.S. Embassy. And that's had a real impact on people. There are lots of stores that are not open right now. There's a bit of a calm. You'll still see, you know, some bakeries open here, flower shops there, but it is much reduced in terms of the amount of street traffic you'd normally see.
Are there celebrations, you know, in the way that they have in past years?
I don't know if celebration is the exact word, but there is essentially a parade of destroyed Russian tanks and military equipment that is on the main drag of Kyiv that a number of people are free and welcome to walk and browse and peruse. And it's sort of a symbol of Russia's failure to capture Ukraine's largest city and a symbol of resistance. You will see lots and lots of mangled and destroyed equipment, burnt out, charred carcasses of these vehicles. Largely the people that I talked to, many of them said that they were going to stay home. It's not quite later in the evening yet. It's to be seen if people really go out to the bars and restaurants tonight like they usually do. We're going to have to see.
You know, when the war began, I think many people in the world were surprised at how resolved and determined the Ukrainian people were. We're now 6 months from that time. Has fatigue begun to creep in? Has the resolve started to fade?
You know what I have experienced in my conversations here is that, in fact, the gruesomeness and the brutality of the war, especially at key moments such as the massacres in Bucha, have basically hardened the public to really oppose an idea of some sort of concessions or negotiations with the Russians. There is a real sort of thirst for, you know, on one level, a vengeance for the crimes that were done against the Ukrainian people, and a strong surge and desire to bind together in a national effort to oust the Russians from the country.
We know that Russian forces have actually escalated attacks because of the anniversary, and yet yesterday we saw the Ukraine Premier League, the nation's top soccer league, get back underway. Put this in context for me to how to understand these two seemingly divergent events.
Yeah, well, there is an incredible split screen when you look at different parts of Ukraine, this very large country that has cities in the south and the east that are absolutely devastated and living under a hellish amount of shelling day and night. Talking about places like Kharkiv, places like Nikopol, places that are quite dangerous to go. And then you'll have other cities like Kyiv, like Lviv in the west, that have a much more calm environment. It's really in defiance of these warnings that, for instance, the U.S. Embassy has put out saying that all Americans should leave immediately and that Russia is poised to strike civilian infrastructure in the country. So you really do have, you know, the best of times and the worst of times when it comes to this country, depending on which city you're in.
That's John Hudson, national security reporter for our editorial partner, The Washington Post. John, thank you so much.
Good to be with you.
We are all familiar with over-the-counter COVID tests, you know, swab, stir, wait. Two lines means you're infected, one if you're not. Well, now a different test is on the way that measures how well you're protected from COVID. It works with a simple finger prick and could answer the question, am I protected today? Edward Chen is a science writer for our editorial partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. Ed, hello.
It's nice to be here today. Thanks.
Good to talk to you. So briefly, how do these tests work to detect antibodies?
These tests work sort of similar to your usual rapid antigen tests in that you have this little cassette-type device. You have something that flows through the device, and they can read the lines to see whether or not you're positive or negative for neutralizing antibodies against the virus. Mm. They actually have three lines. If the first line lights up, that tells you that you are not protected or you're not as well protected against the virus. The second line lights up when you are protected, and the third line is just a control line that tells you that the test is working properly.
What can you tell the rest of us about the science of what's happening here?
So how this test works is you would get a drop of blood, so that would usually be from a finger prick, and if you have diabetes, this would be something that you're familiar with. Mm-hmm. So you take a drop of blood, you mix it with a buffer, and inside that buffer is a protein that comes from the coronavirus. And so if your blood sample has neutralizing antibodies against the coronavirus, then it's going to bind to this spike protein from the virus that is in the buffer of the test.
Okay.
If you don't have any neutralizing antibodies in your blood, then those proteins will get stuck at the first line, and you'll see the intense red color at that first line.
Okay, so just to make sure I'm with you, then if I take this test and I do have the antibodies, then this second line is going to light up, and it's going to tell me, yes, you have these antibodies. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
Who is this helpful for?
Oh, I would say that it would most likely be for people who are immunocompromised. For example, like multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, people who are on some sort of immunosuppressive medication for any sort of reason. For example, if they've had a liver transplant or kidney transplant. One of the lead researchers is a bone marrow transplant physician. And so he sees people who have leukemias, lymphomas, multiple myeloma, who have to get a bone marrow transplant and therefore just basically have their whole entire immune system just wiped out. And they're just unsure what their immune status.
Sure, and yet they still have to go in for medical procedures, right? This would really give them more information.
Yes, yes.
Okay, and how about healthier people? If healthier people are wondering, you know, I wonder if my vaccine protection has run its course and I might need a booster, would they also benefit from this?
I've heard a dual opinion from researchers. One side that's saying, you know, if you can use this test and know how well protected you are, then maybe you can delay a little bit on getting your booster. And that could, for example, let a more advanced booster be developed, and then you will get the more advanced booster and be better protected in the long term, right? There's also another group that says, you know, I'm going to get infected anyways, and so it doesn't really matter to me how well protected I am because I know that the vaccine is going to help me not get a severe case of the coronavirus.
These tests have not hit the market yet. I mean, this research was just published Monday in the journal Cell Reports Methods.
Yeah, yeah. So right now, there aren't any commercially available at-home tests for people to use to measure their antibody levels against the coronavirus. And the biggest barrier for that right now is just that there isn't any large-scale data out there right now that says that if you have this certain antibody level, then you're very well protected. Or if you have this certain antibody level, then you're moderately protected. And so in order for this test to be approved, you know, I would say that there would need to be data that would let the FDA make a decision.
Any thought from the people you talked to on what the timing might be?
Yeah, so I would not expect to see this year, just because those studies need to be done. You need to, for example, take 5,000 people or 10,000 people and then measure their antibody levels over time, track whether or not they get infected, And then based on that, be able to just say, you know, we have a pretty good idea that this is a good antibody level to keep you protected, or that this is not a good level and will not keep you protected.
Okay. And can you just tell us a little bit about the conversation in the research community? I imagine some are very excited about these possibilities, but others might have some skepticism about this. Perhaps that it could give people a false sense of security.
Yeah. So in terms of giving people a false sense of security, I haven't heard that so much because the thinking is, you know, antibodies are one of our primary defenses against any sort of pathogen, including a virus. And so it wouldn't be surprising at all if antibody levels could somehow correlate with the amount of protection that we have. To that, more of the skepticism is just that we don't want to over-rely on something and say, you know, this is exactly what this test means when we don't have the data to back that up just yet.
Edward Chen is a science reporter with our partners at Stat News. Ed, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Quiet quitting. You may have heard it. The term is trending on TikTok, and it's all about setting boundaries at work. Here's user Sarai's Threads playing both a boss and employee.
Did you tell everyone in the office about quiet quitting? This is creating an unhealthy mindset for our employees. But don't you think that telling your employees to go above and beyond for a company that pays them a salary that they can barely live off of, don't you think that's unhealthy?
Now, of course, wanting a work-life balance is not new. But the idea of quiet quitting has gained traction as burnout continues to rise. And for more, we're joined by reporter Taylor Telford, who covers corporate culture for The Washington Post. Hi, Taylor.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Quiet quitting is a weird phrase. It seems like a misnomer, right? Because we're talking about people who want to do good work. They just don't want to do more than they're paid for. They don't feel like giving up their nights and weekends. Is that how you interpret this?
Yeah, that's exactly it. Putting it simply, quiet quitters aren't really quitting. Instead, they're basically renouncing hustle culture itself and kind of quitting the idea of going above and beyond at work. It's kind of a new term for an old concept of employee disengagement. But at the moment, it is really resonating strongly with people across the workforce, but especially those Gen Z and millennial knowledge workers that are really fighting to rewrite the rules of the workplace.
Burnout was already, according to the WHO, at a serious level before the pandemic began. And a study from the American Psychological Association confirms that burnout continues to rise. Do you think that's why quiet quitting is trending?
That's a great question. At this particular moment, it is arriving at a time of unprecedented burnout. And it's coming in on the heels of the Great Resignation, in which workers showed just how much they're willing to walk away from jobs that kind of don't meet their expectations. We saw an average of nearly 4 million employees leave their jobs each month throughout 2021 over clashes of flexibility and kind of a widespread reevaluation of how work should fit into people's lives. And then if you also take even kind of a further step back, it's also happening at the end of summer and ahead of Labor Day when companies are getting ready to make the next kind of return to office push, which is sure to stir up these tensions even more.
This seems to me to be a real reversal in some ways, especially when you're talking about tech and knowledge workers, because it has not been that long since we saw a real, and not just admiration, but actually almost putting some of the tech entrepreneurs onto a pedestal, idolizing people like Steve Jobs when they said they would put in 20 hours a day, or Bill Gates sleeping in his office, and all of these people saying that they basically made work their entire lives. It hasn't been that long since that's the way people wanted to be. That's what they thought success looked like. Is it just burnout that you think is making this change?
You know, that's an interesting point. I think that if we look at the trends in terms of the way that people kind of relate work to their lives over the past few decades, the kind of buy-in actually has been declining, even though, like you said, there's also, you know, this really strong kind of push in some corners to, you know, dedicate your whole life to work. We saw the emergence of the term work-life balance in the 1970s and 80s as baby boomers were kind of trying to find a way to characterize the efforts to achieve a balance between like career and family and having it all. And then we kind of saw Gen X prioritize that balance and kind of embrace like remote work and paid time off. But the difference, I think, in what's happening right now and maybe, you know, much more recently, like in the past like 5-6 years, is that millennials and now Gen Z workers, they're much more interested in finding a career path that will give them the kind of life that they want outside of work, as opposed to the more traditional approach of finding a job first and then building your whole life around, you know, that schedule, your bosses, all that kind of stuff. And then I think, you know, on top of that, the pandemic just really sped things up by physically separating workers from their employers and their colleagues and kind of making it easier for people to see what their lives would be like if work wasn't taking up so much space.
Where do you think this fits in the tug of war that we have seen in the past few years between labor and employers? In other words, it's a tight labor market. Bosses may be trying to demand that workers go back to the office, but workers in many ways are more empowered than they were just a few years ago. So where does quiet quitting fit into this landscape?
Yeah, like you said, the power dynamic between employees and employers has shifted significantly. But the thing that's interesting is that we also have these kind of conflicting signals right now where you're seeing layoffs bubble up, you're seeing kind of cracks form in the economy. But at the same time, the labor market is really, really strong. And the reality for a lot of companies is that for their high performers, those people have a lot of other options right now. And so it's really in companies' best interest to keep those employees happy, even if it means, you know, making concessions to the way that those jobs are done. But for everybody else, I think that quiet quitting has become kind of, I don't know, an off-ramp or a solution that allows people to exercise the kind of control that they want to have over their lives, even if they're kind of lacking, you know, the degree of control that they would like to have to put themselves in a different situation employment-wise.
That's reporter Taylor Telford, who covers corporate culture for The Washington Post. Thank you, Taylor.
Thank you so much.
The summer of flight delays and cancellations continues. On Monday, weather was the main cause, as airlines canceled more than 5% of their flights. There are also crew member shortages, baggage delays. You're upset. I'm upset. And so is Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, who is calling the chaos unacceptable. And he is threatening new regulations if the industry doesn't clean up its act. Here now, resident transportation analyst Seth Kaplan joins us. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Scott.
Okay, airlines have been blaming the weather, pandemic problems like the labor shortage. I was on a canceled flight where the airline didn't even tell me why they canceled. What are they leaving out? What are they not telling us about what's going on?
Well, and part of it is when you mention weather, okay, everybody agrees weather is not within the control of airlines. But what about those labor shortages? Sure, it's a broader issue. But have airlines overscheduled? That's a question here when it comes to, you know, who's at fault, right? Is this something airlines should have seen coming, given that they incentivized a lot of employees to retire early? And so that gets to a lot of what Secretary of Transportation Buttigieg wants here is more transparency.
The secretary is clearly unhappy about what travelers are experiencing. What does he want airlines to do, and does the Transportation Department have any leverage here?
Well, yeah, there's a little bit of carrot and stick. So part of it goes to that transparency. And he says that the department's going to put up a dashboard on its site by September 2nd. So really soon, like a week and a half from now, right?
Yeah.
Where you're going to be able to figure out what you're owed by your airline when your flight is delayed or when your flight is canceled. So number one, there's that. But number two, he's asked the airlines to go back and look at their policies and see if they can make them better. For example, he's asking if a flight's delayed by more than 3 hours for something within the airline's control, he wants the airline to pay for meals, to pay for a hotel room if that's required, sort of telegraphing to them, hey, either do this on your own or somebody else is going to do it for you.
Yeah, yeah. And what are the airlines making of all this? I mean, do they seem to be responding? Is this seen as damaging their credibility?
Well, it clearly is doing that. People are angry at this point. I mean, you mentioned your experience. We've all had those. And I'll tell you one of mine, which kind of goes to what airlines say about these things. So you might remember a couple months ago, we talked about my bags not making it back from Africa. They were mishandled in Europe by Lufthansa. Hey, last night, Scott, I got a check from United Airlines for $1,500 for the three bags.
Okay? Whoa.
$500 each because the bags were delayed by more than 5 days. There's a lot there. Number one, I had to know about my rights and be very persistent to get that. But number two, what airlines say about regulations a lot of times is that they can be expensive because let's face it, in the end, they're going to get that money from somewhere. And airlines say when you make regulations too onerous, they just have to jack up the fares to cover them. And so that's the balance that you have to strike there is getting consumers what they need without, if airlines are correct about that, pushing fares up too much.
Oh, I see. So the money they give, say, to reimburse you, it's going to come from maybe raising my ticket price, that kind of thing.
That's the argument airlines tend to make, Scott, when they talk about new regulations.
Seth Kaplan is here now as transportation analyst. Seth, thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
As the fall semester begins at colleges across the country, the healthcare landscape has changed in many places since the spring. That's after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in late June. For university health centers, that means navigating new and still changing abortion laws. And in some states, campus healthcare providers may have to change how they treat and talk to pregnant college students about their options. Joining us now is Dr. Jessica Higgs, who is president of the American College Health Association. Dr. Higgs, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So can you first give me kind of an overview of what kind of services many health centers on campuses supply?
Most college health centers are primary care offices. So if you think of the primary care office that you go to for your regular health care, that sums up a majority of college health centers across the country. Now, many college health centers may also have additional specialties in their office, and one of those may include an OB-GYN, but not necessarily. So many college campuses in general provide care for reproductive health in terms of testing for STIs or screening. They may provide birth control options. They may do routine pap smears and other routine health assessment in that area. So a large majority of campuses would cover those types of issues.
So what are colleges thinking about or concerned about, especially in states where abortion laws have changed dramatically since June?
Yeah, so we are starting to really look at that, not just starting, but have been looking at it for a while and trying to get really in-depth because it's a different issue for us because it is so different state to state for campuses. So other issues that have come up in the past, such as COVID, was kind of universal across the country, whereas this really impacts some of our institutions and then others are going about their business as normal. So it sort of depends on the state. So we really want to start looking at what the laws are on each state and trying to create kind of a blue book of what that looks like for our institutions. And then things that we're concerned about and looking at how it might impact are things like insurance coverage. Are the insurance companies not going to cover certain medications or certain procedures that they may be covered in the past? Are they going to have access to pregnancy coverage if that's something they hadn't really thought about before? As for our health center physicians, are they comfortable managing pregnant patients that maybe they are seeing more frequently than they had in the past? Or do they have reasonable access to an OB gynecologist in the area that they could refer to and that they have access to that a student would be able to get in relatively quickly for? Looking at childcare, is their childcare close to campus? Is their childcare on campus? If a student decides to have a child, and then how are we going to be able to support that student with that decision? Is there housing accessibility for that student? Generally, you don't think of having a small child in a residence hall, and so do colleges have that opportunity for somewhere that they could live? And over that period of time as well, things like counseling. We've already been seeing a mental health crisis among colleges and across the country, seeing a 40% increase in our counseling centers over the last 10 years. How is that going to impact our visits there? And then any legal ramifications for physicians as well. So is there something coming between the physician and the patient that is not allowing the physician to give the patient all of their options?
Just that, then. Just those things.
Just those things.
that very last thing you said, something that may come between the patient and the physician, what does that mean?
So we, feel very strongly that the relationship between the patient and the physician is confidential between those two people. And they need to be able to have a frank and open conversation without concern of other people becoming involved in that. And physicians feel that very deeply because there are often things that, you know, a patient maybe wouldn't tell their parent or their best friend or their partner, but they will tell a physician because it is important to their healthcare. Most medical documentation is, you know, covered under HIPAA. You just can't get a hold of somebody's medical records without their permission because there are a lot of very private, very individual things in there. And with some of these laws that have been coming out where, you know, maybe potentially a physician could be held liable or be charged with a crime if they suggested that a patient maybe get an abortion or other forms of care, or listing that as one of the options in a certain situation, you know, is concerning on that front of do they have to navigate and they not have an open and honest conversation with their patient.
So you were talking about how widely these laws vary from state to state. Let's take just one. Let's take Texas, where there are very strict limits on abortion. It is illegal after about 6 weeks, no exceptions for rape or incest. This is one of the places that you mentioned that where citizens can sue doctors and other people if they've been involved in providing an abortion after 6 weeks. What does this mean for healthcare providers? What kind of advice can you give someone who is at a clinic in Texas?
And I think that's where we're all just trying to kind of grapple with that information. It's so new and so different in terms of the way that they are wording these laws that we're not really sure what does that mean. How can they hold a physician liable for something that's said in a confidential situation? That's the concern. And then, you know, the discussion of could they be charged if they go out of state? Well, how can a state have jurisdiction over something that happens in a different state? So there's just so many questions involved with how those laws are going to be enforced, and are they legal? That sounds weird to say, are laws legal? But, you know, is that a binding situation? And so at the American College Health Association, we're putting together a task force where they're really going to kind of delve into some of these advocacy issues and hopefully be able to find some reasonable advice to give to not only our members that are in that state, but also to our patients that are in that state and how we're approaching it.
Are some of the providers worried that students might try to terminate pregnancies on their own without the advice of a medical provider because they don't have access to abortion care?
That is always a concern. You know, we know from history that when abortion was not legal, there were lots of procedures that were done that were not sanitary, that were not safe, and were not in the best interest of either the patient or the fetus. And so, you know, being able to provide education of what does this mean, what is this procedure, what is this medication that I'm taking, what are the side effects, that's all things that are really important to have that medical discussion about.
So what would you want either the college, let's start with the college student. What would you want the college student to know about their healthcare clinic as we move into the fall semester in a very different situation than we were in the spring?
I think I would tell the college student right now that if they have medical questions or concerns, that they should go to their health clinic and ask those questions. And all of the physicians and providers that are in the health centers, their primary concern is the patient and that the patient is well and focused and, you know, able to succeed in college. That's really where college health is at, is, you know, we want to help bolster the retention rate for our schools and the success rate of our students by giving them a healthy lifestyle and good health to get through what they want to do with their lives. And so that hasn't changed. While the laws may have changed, the care providers want to give the student is the same.
And then what would you say to these healthcare providers? I mean, because we're talking about two groups of people who may be afraid at this point.
You never want to let fear dictate how you do things. And so I think what we always have to reach down to is what do we feel like is the right thing to do for our patient. And I think the biggest thing that we have really counseled, especially to the providers, is with the laws being so different in so many different locations, it's very hard for us to give, like, you know, very specific advice. So reaching out to their legal counsel, potentially for their university, getting their interpretation of what some of the newer laws mean so that they can feel comfortable in how they continue to provide provide the best care possible.
Dr. Jessica Higgs is president of the American College Health Association. Dr. Higgs, thank you so much.
Sure.
And we have a story on how sororities and sorority members have reacted to the overturning of Roe. You can find it at our website, hereandnow.org.
All right, Celeste, summer technically ends soon, but you and I live in the swampy D.C. area, so August hot. Thank you very much.
Yeah, we have officially until September 22nd, but it's not like then suddenly the switch goes and it suddenly becomes, you know, cool.
Right, which makes it time for cold soups. And Kathy Gunst is here to talk about it. She's here and now resident chef. Kathy, welcome back.
Hello, thanks.
So these are cold soups you're bringing to us, but I don't have to have them cold, right?
No, you don't. They are designed to be served cold, but two of them are particularly well-suited to being heated, and one is okay, but not the best. And I'll take you through it as we go through them. But, you know, if it's suddenly you have one of those cold nights, you can certainly heat up leftovers or try it hot.
Okay, Kathy, let's talk about some of the recipes you have brought to us, starting with the carrot and fennel soup, which means question one is, what is fennel?
Fennel is a beautiful bulb that has kind of, it looks like dill growing up at the top. Those are the fennel fronds. It's an herb that's used very much like dill. It's got a very bright flavor, kind of like licorice and dill combined. And this is a soup that works really well cold and beautifully hot. You cook some onion, you add some of the dill fronds, that herb-like top. Mm. You add carrots, some of the fennel bulb, which is the root of the fennel, and a potato. You then add chicken or vegetable stock. All of these can be adapted to be vegetarian soups. Cook them until the potato and carrot is really tender. You whirl it up in a blender or food processor. And then a really cool thing is to top a cold soup with some of the ingredients that mimic the soup itself. So in this case, I make a very simple slaw. Think of a coleslaw, but in this case, it's made with carrot, again, the fresh fennel bulb, olive oil, and lemon juice, and then a dollop of Greek yogurt or sour cream, and you have this very refreshing light soup with this beautiful salad on top.
That sounds great. Summer is also associated with tomatoes, and you brought us some really great tomato recipes a couple of weeks ago. Listeners, if you missed them, you can go to hereandnow.org and see those. But you have another recipe here for tomato soup.
Yes, this is a Spanish-style soup. Most people are familiar with gazpacho, Spain's most famous cold tomato soup. Yeah. This is called, and I hope I get it right, salmorejo, S-A-L-M-O-R-E-J-O, and it's very similar to gazpacho. All you do, seriously, you don't turn on any heat whatsoever, is you use a cheese grater, the big opening on a grater, and you grate the tomatoes. You soak some good bread in water to soften it. You squeeze the water out. You throw the bread, the tomatoes, some Spanish smoked paprika, and vinegar and garlic in a blender, and the soup is done. You want to chill all these soups for at least 3 or 4 hours to really get them at the right temperature. And then I serve this gorgeous, kind of smoky, brilliantly fresh tomato soup with a chopped up cucumber or chopped almonds or Marcona almonds, the salty, crunchy Spanish almonds. Again, for texture and color, really refreshing, wonderful soup. This is the soup that is least successful hot. This is really designed to be a cold soup.
Yeah. And I mean, you have these garnishes for your soup, things to put on the side or on top. I mean, do you have general rules for how we should think about what can go on top of our soups?
I would say think outside the box. Get creative. You can buy or make lemon oil, which is olive oil with some essence of lemon. You could grate lemon peel. Lemon zest always highlights other flavors. You could make croutons from pre-made polenta that you buy in the grocery store. There's so many different things. Or you want to, as I said, with the carrot and fennel soup, mimic what's in the soup.
So we've got about a minute left here, Kathy, but I want to hear about the summer squash soup, because squash is a resilient and productive plant. So sometimes you have a lot of it.
Resilient is such a kind word. It is taking over my garden. Up and down the street where I live, there are little boxes that say, free, take me home. This is a great way to use up all the end of the season summer squash, be it zucchini, yellow summer squash, or patty pan squash. You saute leeks or onions, you add some fresh thyme, you add the squash and vegetable or chicken stock again, you blend it up, and then I love to top this soup with very thinly sliced fresh zucchini sauteed in olive oil with salt and pepper and a sprinkling of fresh chives. Again, mimicking the flavors, but adding a cooked, different texture. This is delicious hot or cold.
We have indeed been talking cold and perhaps also hot soups with Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst. Go to hereandnow.org for all the recipes. Kathy, thank you as always.
Thanks so much.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong.
I'm Celeste Headlee. It's Here and Now.